Learn Persian with Chai and Conversation, Attar's Parable of the Moths that Wanted to Know More About Their Beloved with Omid Arabian. Salam, Omid Jan. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Salam, Leila Khanum. I'm really happy and honored to be here.
Yeah, we've been talking about doing this for so long, so I appreciate your patience. This is a really important project. I'm very excited about it. And so today what we're going to be talking about is we're going to talk about Attar's Parable of the Moths, for short. And this is for our more experienced Persian language speakers, because similar to the poetry program that we have, we are going to be going through the entire parable, which is 16 lines that Omid has chosen for us. We're going to be going over it in Persian and in English, and then we will be going over the overall meaning of the parable and the words and phrases in them, but we're not going to go into as much detail as we do in the poetry program, which is for complete beginners. This is more about using the language to understand the meaning of this poem. And so I'm super excited to do this. This project, long time coming. And with that, Omid Jan, can you introduce yourself and tell us who you are and what you do?
Sure, my pleasure. I am Omid Arabian. I am the co-founder and director of Universal Center. That's universal with a Y-O-U, so it is about you in the end. And our mission is basically to help more of our fellow human beings access the message and the ideas of primarily the Iranian mystics, like Rumi, like Hafez, like Attar, and to just help those ideas kind of continue to spread and be known and help us hopefully live more joyfully and in more peace with each other.
Wonderful. Well, when did you start this and why did you start it?
Yeah, I've been doing this for about 15 years, and it really started just with my own love of these ideas and these great mystics. And I had been studying them for a long, long time, but primarily in the original language, in Persian. And the whole idea for me to start these classes was to just make sure that people who don't necessarily speak Persian or whose Persian is still not, you know, so perfect, to still be able to access these ideas and hopefully make use of them. So the classes are primarily in English, but we do read the texts in the original Farsi, and then I translate everything, and then we get to talk about and discuss everything, mostly in English, so that everyone can participate.
That's perfect. That's exactly in line with what we do. And we'll definitely have links to Universal on the show notes for this program, so that if you want to in the future explore more of these classes that Omid Jan teaches, that you can go do that. But who are primarily your students?
It's funny. There's a really good mix of people from different places, different age groups, different experiences. So it's not really kind of one demographic. We get people locally. I'm in Los Angeles, and we have people from, you know, the greater kind of LA area, but then all the way out to Europe and Asia, and just whoever can make the time slot, rather, is welcome to join. And so it's and that's really good, because we get these different experiences that people bring to the table. And once we start to apply these lessons to our daily lives, we get different perspectives, which gives us a more kind of rich and varied kind of understanding of what these wonderful sages are talking about.
And can you say a little bit about your background? Like, how did you get into this poetry in the first place? And what did you grow up speaking Persian and reading poetry? Was it part of your family?
Well, I, like a lot of people, I left Iran with my family when the revolution happened in 79. So I was at the time 11 years old, and I was in sixth grade. So, you know, I would have probably not gotten to these ideas unless I had had some exposure as a kid. And I think, I remember when we were growing up in Iran, in the school books, they would have some of these kind of stories just for us to read and get exposed to. Of course, they were kind of shortened version and simplified versions of them, but some of them would stick in my head because they were so beautiful. And even as, you know, a 10, 11 year old, I would remember that they're very meaningful and profound, as much as I could understand it at that age. But then coming to America and getting back to these kind of as an adult, starting in college, I started to really resonate because that seed had been planted in me, because I had had that familiarity. As soon as I would read like a Rumi poem or a story, I would just suddenly kind of, you know, go back to that era and remember how much I loved and enjoyed them. So it just started to grow from that. And then in my 30s, I started to really intensely get into kind of studying Rumi and a little bit of Hafez and so on. And that opened the door into other kind of Persian mysticism and literature that was associated with it. And it just grew and grew and grew, and it became really a major passion in my life. And I'm so really blessed and honored to now be able to help other people also discover and benefit from these ideas.
And was the language a barrier for you? Since you grew up mostly here, it has very complex language. How did you really learn that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, on the one hand, it was lucky that I had kept up my kind of exposure to Farsi, even here in America. Like, I would read books in Farsi. I would try to get my hands on newspapers and magazines, if you remember what those are, and just read as much as I could. And then in college, I took some courses in Persian literature, and that helped me kind of get a little bit more exposed to that. Of course, the language of poetry, and especially mystical poetry, is more complex than even regular poetry, mm-hmm. and especially of any kind of literature. So that always presents a challenge to anybody, I think, of any level of linguistic kind of familiarity. So for me also, it was definitely a challenge, but a lot of persistence and a lot of looking things up and a lot of mm-hmm. just, you know, the more you read of it, the more you get to understand the context clues, so that even if there's a word or a phrase that doesn't show up in your mental kind of capacity or what you're familiar with, you can get a sense of it in the context because of the clues that are usually there. And that's something that I think the poets really intentionally did. Like, they put these words in the kind of context that challenged you to kind of decode and understand what do they mean in this context. And sometimes they can be used in a way that has the opposite meaning than what the usual word meaning of the word is, right? So you just have to kind of be very aware. And then again, the more you read of, let's say, like a Hafez, as you know, the more you get to understand that certain words in Hafez have their own very special meanings because it's Hafez, right? Whereas in regular language, they would have a slightly or very different meaning.
Right. Yeah. We say in our poetry program, it's kind of like these keys that you kind of discover, and it becomes more and more clear to you the more you practice and the more you read. And it's very similar to Shakespeare. Shakespeare is the same. The first time you hear it, it might sound very unfamiliar, but then over time, it becomes more and more clear.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
So now let's bring it to Attar. So Attar is not Rumi or Hafez. And actually, this is the first Attar story that we're doing for Chayan Conversation. So I'm super excited. Tell us about Attar and who he was, when he was.
Sure. So Attar's full name is Abu Hamid ibn Abu Bakr Ibrahim. That won't be on the test, don't worry. he's much better known by his pen name, which is Farid ad-Din Attar. Sometimes they call him Sheikh Farid ad-Din Attar. Sheikh just means an important man or sage or wise man. And he lived from 1145 to 1221 on the Christian calendar. In a city called Neshabur. Neshabur is a major city, or was in Khorasan in the medieval era, and still is in the northeastern part of Iran. And he lived during the Seljuk dynasty. So he's, if you want to put him in context, he was born about 50 plus years before Rumi, and about 170-something years before Hafez. So he predates both of those guys. And there's not a lot of details about his life. It seems that during his lifetime, he was not so well known, actually, as a poet, except in his own hometown of Neshabur. And his greatness was not really discovered until a few centuries later, around the 15th century, is when people started to talk about him.
Well, how many followers did he have on Instagram?
Yeah, exactly. Hard to say. So there's not a whole lot of detail that I can tell you about his own life. There's a lot of interesting, not a lot, there's a few interesting legends about him. One of my favorite ones is that Attar meets Rumi when Rumi was a child. Rumi and his family are presumably on their way out of Iran, kind of fleeing the expected invasion of the Mongols. And so they pass through Neshabur, apparently. And the legend goes that they go out to meet Attar, and Attar holds little Rumi in his arms or on his lap and bounces him a little bit and says, this is going to be a great person when he grows up. So he predicts Rumi's greatness. I mean, nobody knows if it's true, but it's a lovely, lovely story to think about. So there's not a lot of detail, but his work is very much kind of deeply woven into Iranian culture. Not as much as, again, Hafez or Rumi, but he is considered one of the absolute greats as a mystic, as a poet, as a master of storytelling and narrative. And his probably his best-known work is called Mantapote. It's certainly the most translated of his works. And the story that we're going to talk about today is going to be coming from that work called Mantapote.
Is that Conference of the Birds?
Yes, okay. That's Conference of the Birds, exactly.
Yes, so I think that that definitely is well-known among people. It's like well-translated and well-known as a emblem of Sufi storytelling. Is that right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, and both within Iranian culture and in the bigger circles of even kind of Western understanding of Persian mysticism, it's considered one of the absolute greats.
And can you tell us a little bit about what is Persian mysticism? We hear this word like Sufi all the time, this mysticism. What is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very broad term. It can apply to a whole huge kind of body of works, but the idea is that at some point, people kind of started to rise up from Iranian culture and really kind of talk in depth about ideas that have to do with the bigger questions of life. Who are we? What are we doing here? Where did we come from? Where are we going? What's our relationship to the universe? What does it mean to say God, for example? And to understand these ideas, not from a logical, even philosophical perspective, but through a direct experience, a direct connection with kind of the universe itself, with existence itself. And then to express these ideas in a way that was not, again, like I always joke in class, it's not like an instruction chart or an IKEA manual of how to do things, right? It's not like that. It's expressed in a way that's in a language that itself is very complex, but also decodable, so that once you read the work of these mystics, part of the fun and part of the process is to kind of start to understand what, for example, their symbolism stands for. What is it that each image or each idea is trying to represent? And this decoding process can be extremely challenging, but also very, very satisfying. But overall, it is basically a perspective, an approach to understand and explain the biggest questions of existence.
Okay. Oh, wonderful. And then what about, we get to this story in particular, can you tell us, so the parable of the moths that wanted to know more about their beloved. Can you tell us about that? And then afterwards, we'll talk more specifically about this selection.
Sure, sure. So the parable that we're going to talk about today comes from Mantapote. And so I have to explain a little bit about how Mantapote is structured and what is it ultimately about in the bigger picture, if I may.
Of course.
Sure. The title Mantapote itself comes from the Arabic into Persian. Mantel means speech or a verbal expression, right? From the root notch, to talk or to give a speech. And then tear means to fly or anything that flies, basically, in this case, birds. So mantaroter loosely translates into the speech of the birds or the discussion of the birds, but it's usually kind of directly titled Conference of the Birds. Somebody started that and kind of stuck. And it is an epic poem and it's an allegory, roughly 4,500 verses written in Persian when Attar was in his 30s. And Mantapote has an interesting structure. There's a main thread of the story, and that main thread is about how all the birds of the world come together and they decide that they want to have a ruler. They want to find somebody who becomes their king. And one of the birds, who's called the Hoopoe, tells them, well, we already have such a king whose name is Seymour. And all the birds get excited because the descriptions of Seymour sound so magnificent and so alluring. And they say, well, let's go and find and meet the Seymour and designate Seymour as our official king. And so the whole story then becomes about the journey of these birds to go and find Seymour. And the journey is not an easy one. It's a very perilous one. It goes through seven valleys, each of which present a challenge, a difficulty, a hardship, but then also a reward if one is able to kind of pass through that valley. And that's really the main story until at the end, and I don't want to spoil anything, but hopefully they come face to face with designated king, with Seymour. But the whole thing is really an allegory about the mystical journey of self-realization, right? And it's told by this magnificent storyteller called Attar. And so that's kind of really the main structure of Mantapote. But then along the way, with each part of the main story, Attar includes one or several parables. In Farsi, hekayat. And these parables are little short stories that are meant to illustrate and expand on what's going on at that point in the main storyline. So they're like little stories within the main story, and they show up all through Matzavote. And so the parable we're going to talk about today shows up kind of later in the book, later in the journey of the birds, when they're in the seventh valley, which is called Vadi Faqr wa Fana, the valley of poverty and annihilation. So that's where it shows up. That's where it's placed in the story. And again, it's good to kind of remind ourselves, as we were just starting to touch upon, that mystic poetry really invites us to interpret things, right? To interpret everything in any part of the story. And the interpretation has a few different levels. One has to do with just understanding the language, as we were saying, right? The words, the phrases. Of course, we do that with anything we read. But with poetry, and especially this kind of poetry, it can take a little bit more work because, as you all, and I'm sure all of your subscribers and students know, with poetry, the expressions don't always follow the regular rules of syntax and grammar and all of that. So there's a little bit of work to be done already there to understand what is being said, even at the linguistic level. And that's especially true, of course, of Persian poetry. We love wordplay and all of that kind of stuff. That's the first level. And the next level is to just understand the symbolism and start to decode that, which we touched upon, right? And that kind of symbolic language is almost always used by the Iranian mystic poets as a tool of expressing these huge ideas. So often, each of the characters, each of the elements in the story stand for something. They represent something. They symbolize something. And something that's itself is kind of abstract and hard to talk about, so they have to kind of personify it as a character or an object or a thing to help us kind of understand what it is that they're trying to talk about. And so we have to decode that. And then the final level is really getting a sense of then the overall idea that is being discussed through these symbols and through these imagery. So there's lots and lots of layers, but in this lesson, I think we're going to probably start with just the first level, the linguistic, and focus mainly on that. But then I think we're going to spend some time seeing if we can divine some of the deeper meanings hidden behind the surface of the words and the characters and all of that.
Yes, definitely. So thank you for that wonderful introduction. So yeah. What we're going to do, and I want to say that this is for people that have some familiarity with the Persian language, but even if you're not fluent or like completely, you know, like Omidjan says, a lot of people in his class aren't fluent in Persian, they can still understand these poems. We're really trying to get the meanings of the poem. And in the process, we are going to learn a lot of words and phrases as well. We're going to have a PDF guide for this. Omid's put together a really nice guide, and we are going to have each of those words and phrases defined in PDF guide. We'll have, you know, as always, we'll have the Persian written and the English transliteration and the English translation as well. So all of those so that you can really understand this poem on your own terms wherever you're at. And what we're going to do is, it's 16 lines total that Omid has chosen for us. In each of the lessons, we're going to learn 4 of the lines, and we'll go back and forth and kind of talk about the language in that and the meanings. And at the very end, after read all 16 lines, we're going to go back and talk about the parable as a whole and what we can learn from it and how we can apply it to our own lives and all of that stuff. So I'm super excited to get into this. Is there any other final thoughts before we just read our first 4 lines?
No, let's do it.
Okay, wonderful. So Omid's going to read the Persian. I'm going to read the translation. Is this your own translation?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm going to read his translation, and then we're going to read the first 4 lines, and then we'll go back after we're done and talk about each of the lines individually.
یک شبی پروانگان جمع آمدن. در مزیقی طالب شمع آمد.
One night, the moths gathered together in an enclosure. They came seeking the candle.
جمله می گفتند می باید یکی کو خبر آرد ز مطلوب اندکی.
They all were saying, we need one of us to go and bring back a little news, information about our beloved object of desire.
شد یکی پروانه تا قصری ز دور. در فضای قصر دید از شمع نور.
One of the moths went out to a palace and from a distance saw candlelight glowing in the space of the palace.
بازگشت و دفتر خود باز کرد. وصف او بر قدر فهم آغاز کرد.
The moth returned and opened up its notebook and began to describe the candle to the limited extent of its own understanding. All right. That's an exciting beginning. A lot is going on. All right. Okay. So now let's go back through and if you can read that first line again.
Sure. یک شبی پروانگان جمع آمدند در مزیقی طالب شمع آمد.
Okay. So let's begin. The first line is very simple, I think. یک شبی, one night, پروانگان جمع آمدند. So now this is kind of where I get پروانه, as I usually use it, is butterfly. But here we use moth. So let's start talking about that.
Yeah, in modern Farsi, when you say paravane, immediately it brings up a butterfly. But the original meaning and the meaning that from the context we can gather here was being used by Attar has to do with moth. Because there is this very well-known kind of attraction between moths and the light. And before there were electric lights, it was always a flame of a candle. So this kind of relationship between the moth and the flame becomes something that we find a lot in Persian poetry. The poets saw usually, they would see that the way that the moths usually were attracted so strongly to the candle's flame. And sometimes they would even, the moths would even be burned up by the flame, right? And they use this kind of as an analogy, as a metaphor for the power of true, very, very deep, mystical love.
Okay, so this is our first unlocked key is when we see parvane in these poems, which we often do. Don't think of the pretty butterflies that we have now, which is what it's known in modern Persian.
Yeah, and especially if you see the word sham anywhere near the parvone, then that's another confirmation that it's most likely the moth and not the butterfly.
Wonderful. Okay, so parvone gon. Of course, when we add gon, it means the moths, so plural. Jam omadan. So they came, gathered. But then in this case, it just means they gathered. Is that right?
Yeah, came together in a group.
Okay, now this next line, you're going to have to read. It's a lot of words that I actually don't know.
Sure. در مزیقی طالب شمع آمد.
So مزیقی.
Yeah. So مزیقی is, you know, as you know, once you add the E at the end of a word, often it just means one of those things, right? So مزیقی means one مزیق, a مزیق. Now, what is مزیق? مزیق is not a word that we use at all, really, in regular conversational modern Persian. But it's a word that means an enclosed space. Yeah. So mazir is an enclosed space and maziri is an enclosed space.
Okay. So again, we had yek shabi, so one of these nights. And then now we have dar maziri.
Yeah. And I think it's, just to talk a little bit more about that idea, it's important that the moths are in an enclosure, symbolically speaking, right? Where one can imagine that it's kind of dark. And so it adds kind of power and meaning to the idea that they're seeking the light of the candle. They're in a place that itself is dark, and they are yearning and wanting to go and find the candle which emanates this light.
Which candle is sham? And what does the word talib mean?
Sure. So talib, another wonderful word. We do use that a little bit.
Yes.
Talib means seeker, right? It's from the root talab, which means to seek, right? So talib becomes somebody who is seeking, somebody who is after something, somebody who's looking for something. So talib sham means the seeker of the candle.
Mm. And a place that word, like talabkar, is that the same root, talabkar?
It is, although talabkar has a slightly different connotation, which has more to do with like material stuff. Like if you owe me something, I am your talabkar. If I borrowed $100 from you exactly, you are my talabkar. Right? But in the context of mystical poetry, talab has to do with kind of the life's journey of seeking and usually seeking one's own self, one's own meaning, right? One's own highest existence. So the connotation is less to do with being owed something and more to do with seeking something that is really about your own realization, your own self-realization.
Got it. And then we end with the word Amadan. Again, they came. That one's a pretty clear word. So yeah, so again, one night the moths gathered in an enclosure. So maziri, they came seeking the candle. Anything else we want to say about that first line?
I just think it's a lovely kind of a setting of the stage because it already starts you wondering, right? If you don't know anything about these notions, just to imagine and picture this lovely dark enclosure with all these butterflies gather, and then this kind of idea that they're here, not just to hang out, but to look for something, to seek for something. And that thing is a light, something that emanates light, in contrast to the dark space.
And it's already night and they're already coming into this enclosure.
Exactly. So darkness upon darkness. Exactly.
All right. So should we do the next line?
جمله می گفتند می باید یکی کو خبر آرد ز مطلوب اندکی.
I'm seeing it's a K of Vav. Is that, that's pronounced ku?
So K Aleph Vav is pronounced ku because it's a contraction of two words, K U.
Ah, okay, right? Okay.
That, he, she, or it, right? So in poetry, as we have a lot of contractions, this is a very typical contraction
Ke-u.
In Persian poetry, Ke U, but it's pronounced ku so that it sticks, it stays within the meter of the poem. If we said Ke-u, then it would throw off the meter of the poem.
Right. Okay, so the translation. They all were saying, we need one of us to go and bring back a little news, information about our beloved object of desire, i.e. the candle. So Omid has some notes in here, so it's not directly translated. It needs. So a lot of times in these Persian poems, we see, you know, there's four words in Persian, and then you need 20 words in in English to say the same thing.
That's why it makes translating it's so difficult and such a challenge. Yeah.
And it's just so like that first one where you have this Almadan. It's so elegant in Persian and then all of a sudden it gets super clunky in English, which is why we always like to learn it in Persian and to learn those words that have several meanings that just encapsulate so much in just one, in a few words. But okay, so جمله می گفتند می باید یکی. So جمله می گفتند.
So جمله is a sentence normally, right? Yeah. Here it has to do with a collective. جمله can also mean همه, as we say usually in modern kind of like linguistics and conversational Farsi. So it really has that connotation of همه, all of them, basic جمله. So جمله می گفتند means all of them were saying, right?
Okay, می گفتند, were saying, which is a very common word. Mi bayad yeki, and mi bayad is one of those words that you see in written Persian, but not in spoken Persian, but it just means we must.
Yes, and here it has a slightly kind of specific connotation of there must be, right? Mi bayad, there must be, there has to be, it's necessary for, right? Yeki, and yeki here, a one or a someone or one of us.
Okay, and then I've already jumped the gun on this one, but ke'u gets written Ke Aleph Vav, which is, it's actually two words. Ke U, Ke is that, U is he or she, they. How do you translate U?
Yeah, it depends on the context.
Okay.
yeah, it's he, she, it, they, but you got to kind of figure out what fits best in the context of each word.
Right. Khabar arad, ze matlub andaki. Okay, let's go through this. This is also one of those.
So خبر آرد, let's talk about آرد for a moment. آرد is really آورد, right? Again, it's kind of like a shorter version of this word آورد, which means bring, to bring, right? So خبر آرد is to bring news. خبر literally means news or information, right? But also, again, in the context of mysticism, it also means awareness. So it's a really very important word and concept. And really kind of the key to the ultimate thing that the moths are looking for. And in the bigger context, presumably all of us are looking for a kind of awareness, a kind of consciousness, right? And it repeats many times, as we will find in the last few verses of the poem. But here, in the early part, khabar is really set as kind of the main thing that is necessary, the thing that we need. We need khabar. We need someone to go and bring this news or information, but more deeply awareness of the matlub, and we can talk about matlub. Yeah. So matlub, we had talib, talib before earlier in the previous verse. Matlub is also from the same root, talab. But matlub means that which is being sought, that which is being kind of looked for. Talib is the object form, which is the seeker. And matlub is that which is being sought, right? The object of desire. Yeah. And more poetically, that object of desire in Persian mysticism is also referred to often as ma'shuq, the beloved, the object of my love, right? But here, matlub means the object of my seeking, that which I'm ultimately seeking, which here refers back to the candle. That's what they're all kind of in love with or looking
for. Great. And then what does the ze in that arad ze matlub?
Sure, Sure. Ze is another contraction of as, right? So as means of here, right? Lots of these small Persian words that show up with many different kinds of meanings in language, as I'm sure you've said before. The prepositions in Persian just can go anywhere and everywhere, yeah. Right? But here, ze, which is as, just simply means of or from. So, khabar arad ze matlub, bring news of the object of the desire, of the beloved.
And then andaki.
So, andak means a little bit. Or little bit. And then once you add the ye again, it's a little bit, right? So andaki is just a little bit, yeah, just small amount, basically.
Great. And we've gone over the song in Chayan Conversation, Andek Andek.
I was just going to reference that famous Rumi poem and song that begins with Andek Andek, little by little.
Little by little, the people come.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Then I think let's read these first two lines again just to hear how they feel. And maybe we can understand a little bit more now that we've been going through them.
یک شبی پروانگان جمع آمدند، در مزیقی طالب شمع آمدند. جمله می گفتند، می باید یکی کو خبر آرد ز مطلوب اندکی. And by the way, if you're going to be a purist and a perfectionist, you would probably pronounce یکی as یکی.
Ah, okay.
Even though normally we say یکی. But you would probably say یکی just to rhyme better with اندکی. So, but, you know, just for the sake of easier understanding, we say yaki just so it doesn't get too confusing.
I think that a lot of these, it's nice to remember the wordplay that you can do with Persian. You can just really, you mold it to what you need in terms of rhyme and in terms of the measure. So even the ku and the ze is a good example of that as well.
Exactly. Keeping it fluid, as I like to say.
Keep it very fluid. Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay, so the third line.
شد یکی پروانه تا قصری ز دور، در فضای قصر دید از شمع نور.
One of the moths went out, i.e. flew, to a palace, and from a distance saw candlelight glowing in the interior space of the palace. شد یکی or یکی پروانه.
Here I would just say یکی, because we don't have that rhyming issue.
تا قصری ز دور. Okay, so we have the word پروانه in there. شد Yeki became one, parvane moth. Yes.
Right. Yes. Except, again, should also has more than one meaning, right? And usually, yes, we have it in conversational Farsi as became, but from shodan, which is to become. But actually, in poetry, often should is used as the verb to go. So should means went.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Just, again, context clues, but here it means it went. One of the moths went. Shod yaki parvane.
And then ta, like to, qasri, and qasr is a palace. And zedur, so that is very far. But what is the ze? Dur means far, right?
Dur means far.
What is the ze in there?
Ze here, the same as we had in the previous verse, a contraction of as, which means from. So it one of the moths goes, right? Tagasri towards or almost to a palace. And then zedur means from a distance. So from a distance, now we have to go to the next part of that verse to see what happens from a distance.
What happens?
Right? The from a distance, yeah, the from a distance sets up kind of what happens in the next half of the verse.
Dar fazay qasr did as sham nur. So it looked very far away and then...
Looked from far away, Zedur, right? And so the deed is saw, right? But what did it see? Dar fazay qasr, faza means the space, kind of, in this case, the interior space of qasr, the palace. So dar fazay qasr, in the interior of the palace, deed, it saw, as sham, again, from,
uh-huh.
As sham is the candle, from the candle, Nur, which is light.
Well, I wanted to point out that parvanegan jam omadan, and then in this case, we have just one moth that went out to see this sham.
Exactly. One of the moths, exactly.
So I'm excited to see what that means.
Yeah. So another thing to keep in mind is that, again, with poetry, the order of the words, right, are often kind of moved around. I don't need a big book. It's not what you usually expect in conversational, like Persian, right? The order of the words is always moved around so that, or often moved around so that, again, you have to kind of, if you want to say them conversationally, you have to put them back in order, right? In a different order.
Absolutely.
And so that fazaya asr didas sham nur, right? If you were to say it conversationally, you would say that fazaya asr as sham nur did.
Right.
Right.
You would end
so
on
that
the
you
verb.
Would say, from the candle it saw a light.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But the words are moved around, and so but the meaning is the same, right? Once you kind of understand that this moth that goes towards the palace, right? Or a palace and looks from a distance and sees from that distance within the interior space of the palace that there's a light emanating from the candle.
Okay, and then should we go over now the fourth line?
Sure, I just wanted to say one quick word about the notion of palace, because suddenly we have this idea of a palace, like where did this palace come from, right? It just shows up in the poem. And now we understand that the candle is in the palace, right? So because that's where, when the moth looks within the palace, it's the candlelight. So that's a clue itself about what the candle represents, right, symbolically. So it's really asking us to ask ourselves, why is this candle in a palace? What does that say about what the candle might mean or represent in this case? And we'll talk about that once we get to kind of the bigger picture.
All right. Okay, so the fourth line?
Yeah. Baz gashto daftar khod baz kard vasf u bar qadr fahm aghaz kard.
Okay, so baz gash means he returned, baz gasht. O daftar khod baz kard. So daftar, that's all language that we use now too. So daftar is a notebook. And khod means self. So his or her own notebook opened, baz kard. So that's all very simple language, right?
So apparently somehow the moth has been taking notes in its notebook about the candle and the light of the candle.
Right.
Good student.
Okay. Okay, and then this next line has more complicated language, so I'll let you take the lead on that.
Sure, sure. Vasf u bar qadr fahm aghaz kard. So vasf is description.
Okay.
Yeah. So vasf u means the description of he, she, or it. In this case, the u refers to the candle.
Okay.
So the description of the candle.
And is vasf a word that we would use in conversation now?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit bookish, but not so much. I mean, I think that's a fairly common word. Vasfa something is just a description of something. So vasfa u, the description of that, which here is the candle. Bar qadr fahm. So bar qadr. Qadr is a measure of something, right? In Farsi, we say chagadar, your chagad, to be really conversational about it, right? But really the correct is chagadar, how much of something, right? So it's a word that refers to the amount of something. So bar qadre, bar is one of those prepositions that means a thousand things. Here it means to the extension, to the amount of, right? Commensurate with the amount of, as per the amount of what? Bar qadre fahm. So fahm is a wonderful word that means generally kind of understanding. Right, a kind of awareness or again understanding of something. In fahmidam, I understood. Right, so bar qadr fahm means based on or to the extent of its own understanding. So and then aghaz kard began. Right, aghaz means beginning. So aghaz kard means it began something. So what did it begin? It began the vasf. It began to describe. It began to kind of talk about and describe. Ooh, the candle. The moth begins to describe the candle. But how much of the candle can it describe? Bar qadr fahm, to the extent of its own understanding.
Okay, so now I think let's read that third and fourth line together, like we did the...
Sure.
Just to hear how it feels.
Shod yeki parvane ta qasri ze dur, dar fazay qasr did az sham nu. Baz gasht o daftar khod baz kard, vasf o...
And that's a good cliffhanger there. So what is it going to describe?
What is it going to describe? And we have to remember that this moth has only experienced the candle from a distance. Remember Zedur, right? So how much will a moth know of a candle when it has only experienced the candle from a distance, right? So we can kind of, not to spoil anything, but we can kind of expect how much understanding will this moth.
And why is the flame in the palace?
In the palace, also a good
lots
question.
Of good questions. But it is amazing. So like you said, he's from the 12th century Attar, and I always say how amazing it is that we can still read this and understand it at all, and so clearly, you know, someone with the even like rudimentary understanding of Persian can come to understand these poems, and that's amazing.
Absolutely. And I think actually, if we're going to do the comparison to Shakespeare, I don't think Shakespeare is as easily to understand, even, you know, if you are very well versed in modern English, whereas the more you know modern Persian, the more you can still go back and understand this language, which is not that different from what we use today. Certain words, of course, are more archaic, but generally it's the same.
Absolutely. And I mean, there's a big difference between written and spoken Persian in general. So a lot of the differences here are also that, not just because it's a poem, the orders and all that kind of stuff. So that's very interesting. Okay, well, that's it for our first four lines. So we have a lot to think about this week. And then, like I said, we have the PDF guide. I urge everyone to go back and look at all these, get to know each of these words and phrases. On our additional learning resources, we'll have each of these lines individually so you can listen to them over and over again throughout the week and really get to know the language of this before we come back next week to read the next four lines. But I think that's a wonderful introduction to the poem. And is there anything else you'd like to add, Omidjan, to this lesson?
No, I'm excited to explore more together and see what happens to this moth and the rest of the moths as well.
Yes, wonderful. And like we said, we'll link to Universal on the show notes for this lesson as well, so you can learn more about Omid and his project. And we'll be back next week with more of Attar's Parable of the Moths that wanted to know more about their beloved.
Thank you, Layla. Thank you so much.